You may be seated. Our third case today is 13-351, State of Ohio versus Kevin Tolliver. For the appellant, Mr. French.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, good afternoon. I'd like to first begin by reserving 3 minutes for a rebuttal. The issue and the question before this court here is what mental state, if any, should be applied to the use of force element of the robbery statute prescribed in Revised Code 29.11.02A3. That statute provides that no person in attempting or committing a theft offense or in fleeing immediately after the attempt or offense shall use or threaten the immediate use of force against another. The use or threaten the immediate use of force element does not specify a culpable mental state or a mens rea. Because of that reason, the Second District Court of Appeals, in applying 2901-21B, used a default mens rea of reckless as being the necessary mens rea for that element. The Second District Court of Appeal erred in its holding for two reasons. First and foremost, the court failed to conduct the proper analysis for determining when 2901-21B supplies the mental state of reckless to a statute. That analysis is the analysis set out by this court in State v. Wack and State v. Maxwell, which was later reaffirmed in State v. Horner. The Court of Appeals also failed when it improperly interpreted and applied this court's past precedent in cases looking at other subsections of both the robbery and aggravated robbery statutes. For both of those reasons, the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed because a proper Wack-Maxwell analysis, had it been performed by the Court of Appeals on this subsection of the robbery statute, and had this court's prior precedent been properly imposed, the conclusion that must be reached is that the use of force element of the robbery statute does not require a mens rea, and that the robbery statute requires no mens rea beyond that which is incorporated within the theft provision of the statute itself.
And how do you define force?
I don't have the definition in front of me, but I believe force is specifically defined in the revised code. There is a standard jury instruction for defining force.
So is raising one's hand and making a fist force in your view?
It could be a threat of force. It could be a threat of physical harm. Certainly, threatening to punch someone in the face or punch them in the body could be interpreted as a threat to inflict physical harm.
And if someone is blocking your access or retreat and you push them out of the way, is that force?
That is force, and that is precisely the force, precisely the initial force that was inflicted or used by Tolliver in this case.
And so you're saying the force is the push, not the raising of the fist?
Both actions were the force. Principally, though, was the pushing of the clerk out of the way to affect his escape, if you will.
That doesn't necessitate any medical attention or injury of any kind. It's just a touching?
Yes. Infliction of force during the commission or flight following the commission of a theft offense.
All right.
And you're saying that recklessness, the default Default mental state does not apply.
The default mental state of reckless does not apply based upon the Maxwell analysis that this court has held is the proper analysis to use in a case where the General Assembly has included a mens rea element in one discrete clause or subsection of a division or division of a statute, but not in another. This case, you have two discrete clauses. To commit a robbery, you must first commit a theft offense. And while committing or attempting to commit or fleeing that theft offense, the second clause is use or threaten the immediate use of force. Theft is defined as purposely depriving the owner of property or services and knowingly obtaining or exerting control over that property. So the first element, the first clause, if you will, of the robbery statute, the theft element, includes two specific mens reas in its definition. Under the Maxwell analysis, because the second clause, discrete clause, the use of force, does not include a mens rea, this court has held that that is an indication that the legislature plainly intended that element not to have a mens rea and to impose, if you will, strict liability as to that element. In Maxwell, this court narrowed it down a little further and said that a court must be able to answer in the negative the following two questions before applying the element of recklessness pursuant to 2901.21b. Two questions in the negative. One, does the section defining an offense specify any degree of culpability? And two, does the section plainly indicate a purpose to impose strict liability?
And we're not talking about the whole offense or the whole section. That's my concern on 2901B, the language that talks about when we use recklessness as the default. It appears that there may be some incongruity here when you're talking about applying this solely to one element of the offense as opposed to the entire offense.
Yes, 2901.21B imposes reckless if the section defining the offense is absent any level of mens rea. The section defining the offense in this case is the whole of 2911.02, the whole of the robbery statute.
But you also said that there are two mens reas for that offense then.
Yes.
Which one is the default? Which one applies to the use of force then?
Neither. Well, because there is a mens rea in one clause, but not in the other, under the Maxwell analysis, this court has found that that is an indication that no mens rea was intended to apply to the use of force.
So you're saying because there are two mens reas, the fact that there's none on the use of force means that's strict liability. Is that how you're arguing?
Yes, as to that element, because you have a section defining the statute that does include a mens rea for one element or clause of it, the theft clause, but not the other clause, the use of force clause, under Maxwell analysis, specifically Maxwell, that is an indication of strict liability or no mens rea as to that element.
The thought there is that the legislature crafted this statute, imposed purposely depriving the owner and knowingly obtaining the property, and then went on to say with the threat or the use of force.
Yes.
Without mens rea.
Right.
So they knew what they were doing, presumably, and decided to be silent on that, and you can't revert to the recklessness standard.
That is correct.
If you could revert to the recklessness standard, if the appellate court is correct here, Does this behavior, is this behavior reckless?
I certainly believe that this behavior was reckless. I believe that, I would assert that pushing a clerk out of the way or raising a fist is knowing conduct, if not purposely, purposeful conduct. So I certainly believe that this is reckless conduct, and of course the problem that was addressed by the Second District and argued by the defendant is that the jury instructions did not include reckless. The jury was not instructed that reckless was required, was a required mens rea. That is not, however, a flaw, because under the proper analysis, reckless is not the mens rea, and therefore the jury was not required to be instructed on that. So the jury in this case was properly instructed. There was no error in the jury instruction, and the Court of Appeals findings to the contrary are in error.
Do we need to do anything with our decision in Horner if we agree with your position? The Court of Appeals appeared to have some confusion about what it says.
The Court of Appeals had confusion. The confusion that the Court of Appeals had regarding Horner
probably started with us.
Well, the confusion was not with Horner necessarily. It was with what Horner said about State v. Colon.
Okay.
In Horner, this court said definitively, Colon 1 is overruled.
Right.
It then, in Horner, this court went on to apply the Wack-Maxwell analysis. In other cases, this court acknowledged that when it decided Colon, it did not apply the Wack-Maxwell analysis. And what the Court of Appeals concluded was that when Horner, when this court said in Horner that Colon 1 was overruled, it didn't overrule all of Colon. It overruled only that portion of Colon that discussed the structural error versus plain error analysis, and did not overrule that portion of Colon that imputed reckless as the mens rea to the physical harm element of the robbery statute under A2.
Which is why I ask you the question, do we need to further address Horner if we agree with your position here and clarify that, or is this case independent? And
it would,
your input on that.
It would be beneficial for this court to further clarify Horner, or more specifically, further clarify what this court meant in Horner as far as the treatment intended for Colon 1.
So you want us to kill Colon?
I feel, I would submit that Colon 1 has already been killed, and that perhaps since obviously the Court of Appeals in this case was confused over that, making that abundantly clear would be beneficial not only to the Second District Court of Appeals, but other courts of appeals that may feel likewise.
Okay. If I could just, do you have a question? Clarify one thing for me, and it's about the indictment.
Yes, ma'am.
Did the indictment refer to reckless?
The indictment did include reckless as the mens rea for the use of force element, and the reason for that goes back to Colon 1. When Colon 1 was decided, prosecutors' offices throughout Ohio, including the Montgomery County Prosecutor's Office, went into a panic. And in fear that this would be an issue that would keep being litigated over and over again in any criminal statute that was missing a mens rea in a particular element, out of a sense of extreme caution, when in doubt, add reckless. And that is what was done in this particular case, and my understanding is that is the process that was followed by many, if not all, prosecutors' offices throughout Ohio. However, by the time this court, the case got to trial, This case had this court had decided Horner. And the opinion was that Cologne 1 was dead on all aspects and that reckless was no longer necessary given the Maxwell analysis. And therefore, when the jury was instructed at trial, reckless was taken out.
So are you telling us that there are a whole series of cases where we're going to find indictments that contain a reckless element in some of these kinds of situations, and then there'll be questions about whether it should or shouldn't have been?
I believe that that is very likely to happen, and frankly, I'm surprised it hasn't happened more often thus far, considering this is we're in the over three years since Cologne 1. Which perhaps goes back to the original question, perhaps better clarification of what this court intended Horner to mean as far as its treatment of Cologne 1 would be advisable. And I believe it was Justice Lanzinger in
Horner,
Horner,
yes.
Or perhaps even Lester, State v. Lester, referred to Cologne as a quagmire, as an anomaly, a boon to defendants and a headache to appellate courts. This is an example of the sort of headache that the Second District Court of Appeals went through in trying to interpret what it felt was left of Cologne 1.
We still, though, have to deal with the 2901-21B language that talks about the default of an offense. And I think that's where the there needs to be some clarification. And Cologne, really, we were talking about what does an indictment have to say. We finally came to the point that says, follow the statute, you're going to be okay.
Yes.
So that part is laid to rest. But the real question that I have is this idea of when we have strict liability offenses where a mens rea doesn't have to apply, or where we have a missing mens rea, and under 2901-21B, you have the language that says the default is reckless. And I think I point that out in the dissent in Horner, but maybe we need to clarify, or at least the court has to determine what we really mean by that.
Yes, I would agree with that. And if my recollection serves me, there was a case decided by this court maybe a month or two after Horner, State v. Johnson, where it gave a little more clarity to how and when 2901-21B applies, and pointed out that 2901-21B does not come into play at all for any criminal code section if there is a mens rea somewhere in some element of the statute. Because the language of 2901-21B discusses that when the section defining an offense does not specify any degree of culpability, for this statute, the use of force robbery statute, there is a culpability to mens reas in the theft portion of the statute. Since this robbery statute is not the robbery statute does contain and specify a degree of culpability somewhere in the statute, 2901-21B, based upon, I believe, this court's reasoning in State v. Johnson, does not come into play at all.
So we've spoken on that.
I believe this court did speak on that in State v. Johnson, which my recollection is was decided maybe a month or two after Horner.
So I'm reading the Court of Appeals reference. I also dissented in Horner, and they seem to grab onto that.
Grab onto the dissent in Horner.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
And so, to the extent they cite my dissent, they're wrong.
Well, with all due respect to your dissent, I would assert that any
questioners,
unless the dissent can be distinguished some way from the majority and applied more appropriately in the case at hand, I think conventional wisdom is relying on a dissent is an erroneous path to take for an appellate court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Blue.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. I would submit that the Second District Court of Appeals applied the holding of Holder appropriately and correctly in this particular instance. As opposing counsel has discussed, this court reaffirmed its standard in both State v. Wack and State v. Maxwell in State v. Horner, and basically described that analysis as this: the two conditions must be present for the default state of recklessness to apply to a statute which does not otherwise specify some other degree of mental culpability.
And do you not see two other degrees of culpability in this statute, purposely and knowingly?
I see that the statute does incorporate a theft offense, which is then to which are grafted other elements to create the robbery offenses, both aggravated robbery and robbery. I would submit that the culpable mental states that are contained within the discrete theft offense, both A, do not apply to the additional elements, and also do not compel a conclusion that those additional elements which create the robbery offenses are strict liability. The two questions which must be answered to find strict liability in relation to those elements are A, that no mental state is specified within the statute, again, and two, that the statute does not plainly indicate a purpose to impose strict liability. I would submit that it is that second question which really is at issue in this case. The court's analysis of the A1 section of the aggravated robbery statute in Horner relied on Maxwell to hold that the culpable mental states within the theft offense do not apply to the additional elements which create the robbery offenses. So I would submit that the first question required under the WAC Maxwell analysis is answered in the negative. There is no culpable mental state assigned to those elements. So the inquiry then becomes.
So you can't graft in the language of purposely and knowingly in the theft offense as referenced in 2911 to the robbery. That's what you're saying.
Yes, the elements of robbery, the purpose
encompass the offense of theft, which spell out the requisite mens rea to accomplish theft.
Spell out the requisite mens rea for the theft offense mm-hmm. itself as a discrete offense within, as one element of the entirety of the robbery offense. The court's application of Horner, the court's application of the WAC Maxwell analysis in Horner appears to take two parts. First is a textual analysis of the statute, the language of the statute itself, and the second appears to be what I would call a substantive analysis of the actual nature of the offenses. This is identical to what the Second District Court of Appeals did in analyzing the statute under consideration here. They spoke of this court's decision Holder, specifically its identification of the nature of the offense, consideration of the potential harm created by the conduct that's prohibited, and applied that substantive analysis in analyzing the A3 subsection of the robbery statute. The Court of Appeals found that the A3 subsection being the least egregious or found that the A3 subsection was the subsection that held the least likelihood of any kind of severe, any likelihood of potential physical harm or serious physical harm to others. All the decisions of this court that have looked at either the aggravated robbery subsections or the robbery subsections have spoken of the nature of the offense and the type of conduct prohibited. In State v. Wharf, the court said that the potential for violence was greatly enhanced because the appellant had in his possession a handgun. That case was speaking to the A1 section of robbery, which criminalizes possession or control of a firearm. In State v. Lester, this court again discussed the risk of harm increases when a defendant brandishes or displays the weapon. It is rational to conclude the General Assembly imposed strict liability for the brandishing, display, or use of a weapon element in an aggravated robbery.
So you would agree that the having a deadly weapon on or about the offender's person under 2911.02a1 is strict liability?
This court has previously held that it is strict liability, Your
Honor. Okay,
but
in the same section of the same statute, you bump down to 3, use or threaten the immediate use of force against another, you say that that transforms into strict liability, or excuse me, to recklessness.
Your Honor, I would suggest that each subsection of both the robbery statute and the aggravated robbery statute are discrete offenses and should be treated and analyzed as if they are a discrete offense.
You agree with our finding that having a deadly weapon on or about the offender's person is strict liability. Why would you say that? Because the same silence, and it's the same section without a mens rea contained therein. So how can you say under A1, strict liability, under A3, recklessness?
Again, I would submit that each subsection is discrete and that the analysis does not begin and end at the textual analysis or of the construction of the statute, that construction must take a look also at what the nature of the offense is, as this court has done in the prior holdings that it is made in reference to aggravated robbery and robbery. Therefore, I would say that the textual analysis simply stating we have a discrete clause or we have two clauses, one of which has an applicable mens rea, one of which does not, that is a portion of the inquiry that this court conducted in Horner, when this court both looked at the aggravated robbery statute and looked for the presence of a stated mens rea therein, and then also considered the nature of the offense that it was, in fact, construing in that case.
Mr. Blue, do you think this is a confused area among trial judges and defense counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that it is.
So should we clarify Horner? Would that help?
I believe it would help if the court were to clarify what precisely the court intends when it refers to a State v. Maxwell analysis and spell out what steps a reviewing court is to take in examining a subject statute and determining whether it is in fact strict liability or the default mens rea of recklessness.
Well, even in State versus Johnson, we use the two-part test, don't we? I mean, the case that opposing counsel referred to is coming after Horner. We said it's not enough that it's a missing mens rea. You also have to show that there was strict liability intended by the General Assembly, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that's where we get into that second step. What truly constitutes a plain indication to impose strict liability, and is it something more than simply the absence of a mens rea? I would submit the absence of a mens rea is only the first step in the inquiry, seeing as the legislature spoke in 2901.21b that recklessness is the default mens rea for a statute which does not otherwise state one. Then we get into the actual textual analysis or structural analysis of the statute itself, as far as where there are two clauses juxtaposed, one containing a mens rea, one containing none, whether it be within different divisions under a given subsection or different sections within.
In a sense, when you have two separate mens reas in a statute, that suggests that it is not a strict liability offense. There's going to have to, the state has to prove something with respect to the conduct, some intent or some guilty mind, the mens rea, so that if you have the two knowingly and purposely, let's say, the third one has to be recklessness as opposed to strict liability. Would you say that's how it operates?
I would say it would have to be recklessness as opposed to strict liability unless there is something more that can be pointed to within that statute that shows the plain intent to impose strict liability.
And what would that be?
Your Honor, I would think that it would have to be first and foremost that the statute doesn't incorporate any particular mens rea, and two...
No, we're looking at a statute that has mens rea, and as was outlined by Justice Lanziger.
Something analogous to one of the robbery subsections mm-hmm. that has
the theft offense, which has the purposely and knowingly elements for the mens rea. And then you say you tag on the use or threaten the immediate use of force against another, and you say that's silent as to mens rea, so that according to 2901.21b, we'll get you recklessness.
That is our argument, Your Honor. In order to...
Okay, but then you said unless something else is evident. And what my question to you is, what else would be evident, could be evident?
In this particular circumstance, I would argue that it's the nature of the conduct prohibited. It, as this court has previously discussed, the potential for harm, the danger, and whether it's reasonable to conclude that the legislature intended strict liability in this offense in light of the fact that under 2901.21b, they have assigned a default of recklessness.
What import do you, in 2911.02b, which makes an A3 violation a felony of the third degree as opposed to a felony of the second degree, what import do you give to that section?
I would argue that the penalty section is evidence that the legislature considered the A3 subsection of robbery to be the least egregious of all the robbery or aggravated robbery offenses.
So how does that support your position, if at all?
In that they have considered that particular act, the universe of actions that would be encompassed within that subsection, and have determined that that universe is least likely to pose a threat of harm to others or to the public.
Well, it says use or threaten the immediate use of force against another. I guess what's missing there is the infliction of serious physical harm to another. So you could use force as long as it's not serious physical harm, you'll get an F3 as opposed to an F2.
Or an F1, depending on whether it's serious physical harm or physical harm.
Mm-hmm.
I would note, as the Court of Appeals noted, the physical harm under 2911.02, the robbery statute, and the serious physical harm subsection of the aggravated robbery statute, both have alternates of either infliction or attempt to inflict.
You're saying under this standard, even if we were to agree that reckless was the appropriate one, this does not meet the reckless standard? Your client's behavior.
The facts of this case?
Yeah.
Your Honor, that's a question for the finder of fact. It clearly was not presented to the jury. It was argued to the jury in closing by the state that nothing had to be shown in the way of culpable mental state, that the simple existence of any force was sufficient to constitute the offense. In this particular case, force for the robbery statute is defined as any violence, compulsion, or
constraint
physically exerted by any means upon any person or any item, anything actually is how it defines it. So this really is the catch-all statute within all robbery statutes. It encompasses a far greater range of conduct than any other subsection, either under robbery or aggravated robbery. Even with this court's prior holdings relating to when strict liability applies under the aggravated robbery statute and the robbery statute, the only actual factual occurrences which would bring in strict liability are the existence of physical harm or serious physical harm, the possession or control of a weapon, or the display or use of a weapon. The attempts to commit physical harm would still require a mens rea under the attempt statute.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. French, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
I would disagree with my colleague's statement that the Court of Appeals applied Horner properly or appropriately. I would submit that the Court of Appeals did not apply Horner at all. It made reference to Horner, but only to clarify what Horner did or did not say about State v. Cologne. What Horner held is that the analysis that must be applied in cases like this is the analysis this court set out in Wack and Maxwell, and the Court of Appeals did not do that analysis at all. So it did not apply this court's holding in Horner appropriately. It did not apply it at all, which is one of the basis for why this court should overrule it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decisions. Thank you, gentlemen.